Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Shoftim. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Shoftim. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Shoftim. In a previous podcast, I discussed how this parsha outlines the four institutions of leadership of the Jewish people: the judges, the priests, the king, and the prophet. From the book of prophets, from these books of prophets, we know the connection between prophets and kings. Prophets play an instrumental role in anointing the kings. Prophets are also the counterpoint to the kings when they go astray, who somehow try to point them in the right direction. In our parsha, we see the connection between priests and judges. This comes up in the beginning of the parsha, when we are told that if there is some sort of decision that is beyond our scope, that the judges need to go up to the high court in order to get a final decision. And where is the high court located? This is chapter 17, verse 8. The high court is to be found in the place which God has chosen for himself. And in verse 9, it says, "And you will come to the priest, to the Levite, to the judge," which is in those days, "and seek out, and they will tell you the matter of judgment." The juxtaposition between priest and judge finds its expression in Jewish law. Maimonides codifies what appears in rabbinic literature, that there is actually a preference to appoint judges from among the priests and the Levites. We can see this juxtaposition also at the end of the parsha, when it speaks about Egla Rufa, the heifer whose head is chopped off as part of an expiation ceremony to somehow cleanse the Jewish people in a case where a murder victim is found between two cities, and we are unable to locate the murderer. And in chapter 21, verse 2, it says, "And the elders and the judges shall go out, and they will measure which city is closest." And then the elders of the city are supposed to take this heifer into a dry riverbed, and ultimately to chop off its head. And then we are told in verse 8, "And the priests, the sons of Levi, whom God has chosen, shall then come and confess and say that our hands have not spilled this blood, our eyes have not seen it." Right now, what I'm interested in is the connection between the Levites and the judges. And in particular today, I would like to focus on the judges and the judicial system. And on the concept of tzedek, justice. Let me begin by saying, the high court is found on the Temple Mount. The temple is the domain of the priests. And a number of commentaries say the reason for this is because the judges are supposed to draw their inspiration from God, that the proximity to the presence of God will enable them to give true judgment. And it seems that this proximity to God is then to filter down to all of the other courts that are part of the system. In fact, the model for the high court is based on chapter 12 in the book of Numbers. Moses is to gather 70 elders and to share the spirit which is upon him with them, so that the 70 elders, together with Moses, will form a court of 71, and they will lead the people with that Spirit of God, which is so endemic to Moses from the moment he encountered God at the burning bush. Let us now examine the idea of the judges in more detail and go back to the opening verses of the parsha. You can find this in chapter 16, verses 18 to 20. Judges and policemen you shall place to you in all of your gates, which the Lord your God is giving you to your tribes, and they shall judge the people righteous judgment. Verse 19, do not deviate from justice or cause justice to be deviated. Do not show favoritism, literally to recognize faces. Do not take bribes, because bribes blind the eyes of the wise and distort the words of the righteous. And then the famous verse 20, righteousness, righteousness you shall pursue, in order that you will inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you. I would like to examine these verses in detail, compare them with some other verses that we find in the Torah, and to base myself today on a number of rabbinic statements to understand what our expectations are of judges and what our concept is of justice. So let us begin. The opening verse says, judges you shall give to you in all of your gates. Who is this verse addressing? Who are the ones who are now being invested with the obligation? And Maimonides says, this is a mitzvah to appoint judges. The simplest way of understanding this, and Hirsch discusses this in his commentary, is that this is a commandment which is being given to the nation as a collective. You, the nation, are to see to it that you create a judicial system. But how does the nation do that? And Hirsch comments, this is done through what could be called the eyes of the nation, the representatives of the nation. And based on a rabbinic comment from the Talmud in Masechet Sanhedrin 16b, Hirsch says that there is a whole procedure of how we appoint judges. The most immediate thing which needs to be done is to appoint a high court. That high court needs to have a head judge. And if I go back to what I mentioned earlier, the model for this is Moses in chapter 12 of Numbers. We have a leader who then gathers together a high court. And Maimonides says that high court is the first thing that needs to be established. And as I mentioned earlier, their place is on the Temple Mount, in the Temple courtyard. From there, in the time of the Temple, there would be appointed two lower courts, which were also on the Temple Mount. If the High Court has 71 judges, the lower courts have 23 judges. But from there, there is a need to appoint judges or courts for every tribe and courts in every city. And so there is this hierarchy where I have the lower courts, which are in each city, a higher court above them, which is the court of the tribe. And although it's the same number of judges, but it would seem to be that the more competent, quote unquote, judges will be in the tribal court. Beyond that are the courts which are on the Temple Mount. And ultimately, at the top of the pyramid is the high court. To come back to our opening verse, the initial directive is being given to the people to establish a court system. And in the Talmud, they describe the process of how you go about doing it. I would like to offer a complimentary explanation, which I think will find its echo throughout the remaining verses that we will be looking at. When it says, Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha, you appoint the judges, you is looking not only at the collective Jewish people, you is not only addressing the chief judge, the Moses of each generation, you is actually addressing each individual with the idea that ultimately each individual should recognize the need for justice. Each individual should recognize the need to have a judicial system that will implement and instruct the people in what is just, so that ultimately it is not just a system which is going from the top down, but it's a system that ultimately gets its nurturing, ultimately is fed from each and every individual. And therefore, it's very important to see what I would call the symbiotic relationship. Ultimately, the power of the judges and their ability to judge properly will be influenced by the sense of justice and the desire for justice of each individual in the nation. And conversely, each individual in the nation needs to be inspired by the judges who set the tone, who are the model. But you cannot have one without the other. So that the point which I would like to make is that ultimately to have a system of justice, it's not enough to just have judges who are appointed, but it is absolutely essential that each individual appreciate, understand, desire the pursuit of justice, so that justice is something which becomes a mass phenomenon. Let me actually illustrate this in the continuation of the verse. It says in the continuation in chapter 16, verse 18, judges you shall appoint, and they will judge the people with righteous judgment. And then it says subsequently, do not corrupt justice. Do not show favoritism. And our gut reaction is to in fact say that who is this addressing? Clearly, it is the judges. When it says in verse 18, and they will judge the people, righteous judgment, that's the judges. When it says, don't deviate from justice, don't show favoritism, don't take bribes, we're addressing the judges. It's actually very interesting that there's a rabbinic comment which appears in the Sifrei, the Midrash Halacha, which says the following. When it says in the verse, and you shall judge the people, righteous judgment, it says this is referring to the appointment of the judges. When it says, don't deviate in judgment, don't show favoritism, the Midrash Halacha says this is actually referring to whoever is in charge of appointing judges. And they go on to say, and perhaps you will say, this person is handsome, I will make him a judge. This person is mighty, I will make him a judge. This person lent me money, I will make him a judge. Therefore, the Torah says, do not show favoritism. Do not acknowledge the face, the personality of the one that you're appointing a judge. Appoint them a judge solely based on objective criteria of who are the best people who will be able to bring out righteous judgment. What do I want to say with this? then in fact, the verse which at face value is addressing the judges and how careful the judges need to be in exercising judgment. That verse is understood in the Midrash Halakha to actually be addressing a prior situation. The people who are appointing the judges and saying to them, be very careful on what basis you appoint the judges. Because if you appoint judges based on favoritism, based on some outside, ulterior motives, ultimately you will be corrupting justice. So that we're not only speaking to the judges, but to the nation. And I would take this one step further and say that when it says, do not pervert justice, it is also true on a micro level. Because every individual, numerous times in their day-to-day existence, needs to judge situations, needs to adjudicate between people. We all know this as parents, when there are fights between children, whether between our own children among themselves or between our children and other children. We need to judge the situation and decide what is the appropriate response to make. And we also know very well as parents how very often it is easy to perhaps be more understanding and show favoritism to our own children relative to other children, or even among our children, perhaps to the baby relative to the older children. And therefore, these verses become extremely important because it's not only addressing the judges, but in fact, each individual. Let me now show a few examples from the Talmud, from the Midrash Halakha, to show the expectations of what in fact is proper judgment and how easy it is to make wrong judgment calls. And in order to do this, I'm actually going to jump to a parallel set of verses which appears in Exodus in chapter 23, verses 6 through 8. In Exodus, we are told, this is similar to our verse, do not deviate the judgment of the poor person in his dispute. Distance yourself from falsehood, verse 7. And then verse 8, do not take any bribes, because bribes blind the eyes of the wise and distort the words of the righteous. Very similar to the verses which we have. What do the rabbis have to say about this? So let me give you a few examples. First example, when it says, do not deviate the judgment of the poor, in the Mechilta, the Midrash Halakha, it says, this verse is talking about one who is evil. And it's saying, in fact, do not say, since this person is evil, I will turn the judgment against him. Which very simply is saying, do not start with any preconceptions based on the personalities of the individual as to who is right and wrong. And even if I have somebody who is the most righteous individual in a dispute with somebody who is evil, I can't allow myself to start with the preconception that obviously the righteous person is right, but I have to judge the facts and not base my judgment on the people. And as I mentioned earlier, how true is this in how we relate on an individual basis to people? To what degree, when we have to make judgment calls, do we base it on the objective facts and trying to get to the truth of the situation? Or do we automatically reach conclusions based on the personalities? I might even take it one step further and say, if I take this midrash, that it could even be that in a situation where I know that the facts are that the evil person is actually correct in this situation. I might still judge against him because of the feeling it's coming to him. He's evil. He should be punished. And what this is saying is, that's not just. You need to look at each situation on its own terms. Another example. In verse 7 in Exodus chapter 23, it says, distance yourself from falsehood. And in the Talmud, Masechet Shavuot, that deals with oaths, 31a, it says, how do we know that if a judge knows that there's a particular case which is fishy, quotation marks, and he's very suspicious. For example, witnesses are testifying, but he's suspicious of their testimony. It doesn't resonate. Something doesn't sound good. How do we know that he shouldn't say, but the witnesses testified, and if there's something which is wrong, then let them pay the problem. Why should I now have to necessarily overly exert myself? I will simply go through the channels. What are the channels? My job is to accept testimony as long as this testimony has been accepted. Even if in my gut I feel there's something wrong here, let me leave it at that and just say the witnesses, if in fact they are testifying falsely and there's no way that I can disprove them, so let the punishment fall on their heads. Therefore, it says, distance yourself from falsehood. I'll jump a second, because there's another comment which appears in the Talmud, which says, in Leviticus, in chapter 19, you'll just give me 1 second. I lost my place. Chapter 19, verse 15. It says, do not act perversely in judgment. Do not favor the poor. Do not show honor to the great. With righteousness, judge your fellow. In the Talmud, it says, over there it says, with righteousness, judge. And in our verse, in chapter 16, in Deuteronomy, verse 20, it says, justice, justice, you shall pursue. So the Talmud asks, why in one place does it mention the word justice once? And by us, it says it twice. And the response which is given is because there are some times when it's enough to just have justice. And there are some times when justice, justice, you need to have double justice. And not only double justice, but to pursue that. And when is that? And the Talmud says, in a case where you're suspicious, in a case where you feel there's something which is wrong here, because either the person who's presenting the claim has a problematic reputation, or because there's something which just doesn't resonate. And therefore what the Talmud says is, a true judge cannot rest until he ultimately discovers the truth. And if in his gut he feels there's something wrong, he can't pass judgment and say, but I was just following the rules, just following the procedure, and what else could be expected? The expectation is that that judge will do everything to get to the heart of the matter. What this says is that there's a tremendous responsibility which is placed on the judges if they really care about getting to justice. If I continue for one moment in that verse which appears in Exodus, It says, distance yourself from falsehood. It says, how do we know that if two people come to a court, one person dressed in rags, one who is wearing very expensive garments, that we say to the one who is wearing the expensive garments, change your clothes, or else clothe that other person in the same way? Because it says, distance yourself from falsehood, which means that once again, it is very important for the judge to be as objective as possible and to not start out with any preconceptions and to not allow anything to color his judgment. And the Talmud goes on to say that that also means you can't allow one party to present their argument when the other party is not present, because it's important that the two parties are given a fair hearing. I mentioned earlier the verse in Leviticus, in verse chapter 19, verse 15, where it says that you shouldn't show favoritism to the poor or to the rich. And in the Talmud, or the Midrash Halakha, they also say the judge needs to be very, very careful not to say, this person is poor, and in any event, the rich person has an obligation to give charity. So why not acquit the poor person and allow him to receive charity in a more respectable way? Therefore, the Torah says, that's not justice. That's charity. But charity has its context, and in a court of law, one needs to exercise justice. And by the same token, the reverse way, someone who is very rich, someone who is very established in the community, the judge can't say, but how can I rule against them? He will be humiliated. It can be very, very undermining, perhaps not only for him, but for the whole community. Therefore, the Torah says, do not honor the great one. It's very, very important for us to keep in perspective where we need to show respect, where we need to show kindness, and where that has no place. In a court of law, the focus needs to be on what is just. I would like to end with two more points. To come back to our parsha, in chapter 16, verse 20, when it says, Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirdof. And remember, the question is, why repeat it? And why the idea of pursuing it? There's a rabbinic comment which appears in Masechet Sanhedrin, which says, one is coming to teach me regarding judgment, and the other regarding compromise. And then they say, how is this? For example, two boats which encountered each other on the sea, and there isn't enough room for the two of them to pass through a certain passageway. And if they attempt it, they will inevitably collide and sink. But if they allow one to go first and the other afterwards, then they can pass through. What should they do? And it says in the Talmud, if one of the boats is loaded, laden, has all kinds of merchandise, and the other one is empty, let the one with the merchandise go through. If one of the boats has a long distance to go, and the other one has a short distance to go, let the one that has the long distance take precedence. And I will now insert, and that is justice. Because if there is a compelling reason to favor one over the other, then it is just to do that. But what happens if both of them are equally distant, or both of them are equally filled with merchandise? Then strike a compromise between them and let one of them go first and in some way compensate the other one. And this is the compromise. I find this example very, very telling because at face value, we're not talking about a court of law. we're instructing individuals how they need to behave. If we had to take an analogy, right? You're on a road, which is one lane, and we all know that, and traffic is going in two directions. And then there's always the question of which one has the right of way. You're going through a tunnel. And we're all familiar with the fact that there are always signs which are telling you which one. But on what basis do we make that decision? So that what this rabbinic interpretation is doing is telling you that there, first of all, are situations where, which are clearly just, where A has the right of way. And there are other situations where you should make a compromise. And where if you give A the right of way, then we should compensate B. But all of this is speaking on the micro level, how individuals need to pursue justice. And what is also interesting is that justice is not only insisting on what's right, but also knowing how to compromise. Let me end with the following point. There are a number of places in the parsha where it speaks in very, very harsh terms about executing capital punishment, putting various people to death who have committed capital crimes. And the Torah uses the expression, "Ubiyarta hara mikirbecha." You should eradicate the evil from your midst. And the Torah also says, "Lo tachos," do not have compassion. That's one side of the coin. And at the same time, there's another side of the coin. And to just give this as an example, in chapter 19, when it speaks about the cities of refuge, it says that if somebody killed unintentionally, they need to run to the city of refuge. And not only that, but the cities of refuge were placed equidistant so that there were three cities of refuge and the land of Israel was divided into four sections so that, in fact, you would not have to go too far wherever you were to reach a city of refuge. And it says, be careful about that, because we don't want the avenger of the blood to kill this person who should not be killed. In the same section, it also says, but if someone killed intentionally, don't allow them to use the city of refuge as an escape haven. Bring them to justice. Eradicate the evil. See to it that the innocent blood which was shed is somehow avenged. And this appears also at the end of the parsha. When a dead body is found, someone who is murdered, we don't know who the murderer is. There's a whole expiation ceremony. But at the very end, the Torah says, and you eradicate the innocent blood. And the rabbis derive from this, if after this whole ceremony, the murderer is actually found, bring him to justice, execute capital punishment. And in that way, we see that innocent blood is not spilled anymore. The point which I want to make is the following. Exercising justice is very, very complex. It requires getting to the heart of the matter to verify what the facts are, that we don't allow external considerations to in any way color our decision making, and that we don't allow our emotions to also get involved. And although compassion is a central theme in Judaism, and in fact, the temple is the ultimate expression of compassion and of the desire to maintain life. And although in a court of law, we bend over backwards to do everything to not actually execute capital punishment. But nevertheless, we can't allow that compassion to somehow prevent us from executing justice when justice needs to be done. This is the challenge of our parsha. And I will end with what it says in the verse of Justice, Justice You Shall Pursue. Pursue justice so that you will live, so that you will inherit the land, possess the land, which the Lord your God is giving you. Which means that ultimately, our ability to live in the land, to maintain possession of the land, is predicated on our ability to exercise justice. And to conclude with how I began, it is not enough to just have judges who execute justice, but it is absolutely essential that they be a model to the people, and that somehow, on a mass scale, each individual, in every facet of their life, learn how to exercise judgment, how to do that which is right, so that in the end, we can have a truly just society, which is the basis for our existence in the land. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.